listen, listen, listen. God is speaking to us.
Kairos Milwaukee United Church of Christ presents Thanksgiving at Job's House, a sermon by the Reverend Rick Skidmore, presented on Sunday, November 24th, 2013.
And now a few verses from the book of Job. The book of Job in the Hebrew scriptures is really one of the great treasures of the Bible. And you pretty much know the story. You know the story more or less. Job was the richest guy in town, but in a single day, he's wiped out. All of his oxen and camels get rustled by, and his hired hands are killed. A hurricane hits his home and destroys his children. And then what happens after that is that he rails at God, Job does, and curses the day that he was born. He prays to die, but his heart keeps on beating. He prays for the sun to go out like a match, but it keeps on shining. And his wife advises him to curse God and then go out and hang himself. But he can't bring himself to do that because he is a good and religious man, which is part of his problem. If God is so bleeping awesome and mighty and all-powerful, then why do bad things happen to good people and the innocent suffer? That really is the question that the book of Job poses. Job has four well-meaning but insufferable friends who come over to try to cheer him up and explain things to him. And this the conversation that Job has with his friends kind of gives us a taste of his inner struggle and turmoil. I mean, these are conversations that we all of us have had at one time or another. But finally, at the end of the book, God has heard enough, and so God presents God's credentials to Job in this wonderful passage, this aria, composed almost entirely of the most gorgeous and preposterous questions that have ever been asked by God or anybody else. So here are a few selected verses from the 38th, 39th, and 40th chapter in Job. This is where God turns the table and questions Job's existence. Who is it that darkens counsel by words without knowing? I will question you, and you shall declare to me, where were you when I laid the foundation of the world? Tell me if you have understanding. Who determined its measurements? Surely you know. Have you commanded the morning since the days began and caused the dawn to know its place so that it might take hold of the skirts of the earth? Have you entered into the springs of the sea and walked the recesses of the deep? Where is the dwelling of light? Have you understood the expanse of the heavens? Where were you when the morning stars sang together and all the heavenly beings danced? Declare, if you know. The springs of the sea and the storehouses of the snow are mine. Who has cut a channel for the torrents of rain and a way for the thunderbolt to bring rain upon the desert and to make the ground put forth grass? Has the rain a father? Who has put wisdom in the clouds or given understanding to the mists? Is the wild ox willing to serve you? Will he spend the night at your crib? The wings of the ostrich wave proudly, but are they the pinions of love? The young lions crouch in their dens. The sea creatures make the deep boil like a pot. Have you given the horse strength? Have you clothed his neck with thunder? Does the hawk fly by your wisdom and stretch her arms toward the south? Have you an arm like God? Can you thunder with a voice like mine? Can we each of us take courage and strength for our own struggles in the hearing of these sacred words? So before the story of Job came along, God had pretty much been locked up in a straitjacket, in the straitjacket of the holiness code that is found in the first five books of Scripture, the Torah. And the heart of that, the heart of the Hebraic law in those books was a world of black and white, a world of clear-cut cause and effect. Do good, you'll be rewarded. Mess up, you'll be punished. God prospered good and punished evil. And Job here is a story of an ancient ancestor of ours who thought that he could control his life and the lives of those he most loved and cherished by acting justly and being correct in his behavior and proper in his church going. Job thinks life and worship and living his faith means doing everything just right, you know, being on top of the food chain. Think having the biggest brains sometimes has us thinking that we can control life, that we can control life's events. And so we develop illusions that if we just do the right thing in the right way, that life is going to be for us smooth sailing, that we can make people love us, or we can keep our loved ones from being hurt. Just by being just and upright and ourselves, we develop these illusions that we can guarantee happiness in life by being good and showing goodwill toward other people, that right, happy thoughts, right actions will result in a happy, trouble-free, shiny life. How's that working for you? I think it's a simple and long-established human equation. You know, if you obey the law, if you obey the moral law, then you're going to prosper. If you disobey and ignore it, then all hell is going to break loose. I mean, as you sow, so shall ye reap. The book of Job was written during the time of the exile, a time of stern determination and struggle and deferred hope for the Hebrew people. Their nation had been leveled. Their temple was a smoldering heap. And the people themselves were displaced. They were forced to live as refugees in makeshift shelters, you know, in high school gyms and convention centers, with the promise that FEMA would soon be in touch. It was this context, it was this, you know, historical, political context, in this context that the author, the writer of Job, raised a different possibility about how to see the world. The possibility that we are rewarded or punished not according to what we do or what we don't do, much less according to the sins of our fathers or grandfathers, not according to what we deserve or what we don't deserve, but only according to our ability to receive grace, to receive what good comes into our lives. In other words, the divine economy is not a system of rewards and punishments, but rather a system of mystery and grace. And God is not some great cosmic bully. God is rather this architect of power and magnificence and boundless incandescence and grace. So this is a subversive story. The story of Job is a subversive story, but as subversive as you can get. I mean, it's grand satire. That's what it is. Written to challenge those who insist that everything can be explained in the world in terms of cause and effect, in terms of obedience and disobedience. I'm convinced that if the author of Job were alive today, that he or she would be a writer for The Daily Show or for The Colbert Report. Job's story is really one of the masterpieces of in Scripture of irony and satire, designed to challenge our thinking, to challenge the status quo. And that really is, I mean, Job isn't unique in that regard. That irony is really woven throughout the Holy Scriptures. There is this counterculture narrative that follows the dominant narrative throughout Scripture that is full of irony and fancy and fable. I mean, from Abraham to Sarah, from Ruth to David, and finally to that skinny Jewish man, Jesus, who speaks the most stunning possible revolution of all, you know, challenging that literal legalistic understanding of God, our petty insistence that God really needs to behave like we think God should behave. William Blake wrote, "There is always somebody playing Job." And by that, I think he meant that there's no suffering that Job underwent that we cannot identify with on some level. I mean, thank God that few of us have it happen to us all at once, that we lose all of our wealth and the death of our children and the destruction of our reputation, all while undergoing a case of the shingles. But even in the relatively minor suffering that we all of us endure, I think that we can find the story of Job compelling. It's really one of the epic legends of our culture. It was written some 2,500 years ago. It has a kind of deep resonance that can allow for new insights on our part, a new way of understanding God. And this may seem like an odd choice for the season of Thanksgiving, but I like to mess with you. What can I say? I mean, at the very time of year when we're asked to offer up our gratitude, why would we want to ponder this story about deprivation? As we approach, this national holiday that celebrates abundance and the gathering of families, why would we want to consider a man who lost everything, including, for a time, his faith in God? Well, I think for too long, Thanksgiving, as it's practiced in the United States, has been dominated by a kind of tribal mantra that would suggest that the reason our nation enjoys so much prosperity is because God's pleased with us. God's pleased with our nation, pleased with our hard work and our enterprising spirit. And our wealth, the amount of food heaped on our tables is an outward visible sign of God's approval and God's favor, right? We must be doing something right. I mean, for things to be going fairly well for us. But there's a dangerous corollary to that kind of thinking, which is you must be doing something wrong if you're facing poverty or disease or hunger or suffering. At this time in our history, I think we do well to really remember the true plight of those first pilgrim settlers. I mean, the original Thanksgiving didn't have a whole lot to do with a sense of entitlement or God's favor. I mean, Thanksgiving Day was born out of this harsh and brutal struggle to survive. Landing at Plymouth was a mistake. Landing in December was near disaster. By springtime, 44 of the original 100 settlers had died. So it didn't appear that God had gone out of God's way to bless these folks. But counting it up after the autumn harvest, if they rationed their food carefully enough to last them through winter and so they had seed enough for the spring planting, then indeed it was a time for them to to rejoice and to be glad and to express gratitude to God, but also gratitude to the Mashpee Wempatpak tribe for showing them how to plant corn and how to catch fish. I think if you're looking for a way to say thanks in the midst of life's uncertainties and hardships and grief and hard knocks, then the story of Job really is for you. It has a lot to teach us. But we have to first come clean on some of the nonsense. Job was not patient. Whoever came up with the expression, the patience of Job, didn't read the book. Because for the record, Job doesn't take this massive misfortune that comes into his life, he doesn't take it sitting down. He doesn't take it with quiet, faithful submission. He rails. He rails at God. He wants an explanation. And he receives no comfort whatsoever from his family or from his friends. The God Job worships at the beginning of the story has to be discarded in order to understand him and his story. The God who rewards good and punishes evil, the God who promises to treat you a whole lot better if only you'll worship God the way that I do, this God, the story tells us, is fake, an illusion. William Blake put it this way. This was his take on the book of Job. The God of cause and effect is really only Satan masquerading as an angel. Every man and every woman judged by this God, a God of your own construction, is doomed. This God is entwined with the serpent of materialism and greed and absolutism. In other words, this God is worse than no God at all. So let's take a look for a moment at Job's friends, whose advice always gets sort of filtered through our own life experiences. Job's first friend, Job's first comforter, sounds kind of like one of those lifestyle coaches. You know, proclaims that, you know, ultimately what you're going through here, yes, it's difficult, but it's only going to make you stronger. This is going to pass. What doesn't kill you outright will only make you stronger one day at a time, blah, blah, blah. And then the second friend, the second comforter, sounds like he's had some experience on Wall Street, maybe as a commodities broker. He says, you know, Job, we can turn this misfortune around. I mean, even though the markets are depressed, that we can work the market to your benefit if you just try harder and trust me. And then the last friend, comforter, was probably a lawyer who had some experience with plea bargaining, who says to Job, what you need to do is negotiate a settlement here, because just screaming at God and complaining is only going to get you a more unfavorable verdict. So negotiate. And then there's Job's devoted wife, who encourages him to curse God and die. Yeah, if I had a nickel for every time Alfreda offered that advice, I tell you. But bitterness here and a refusal to face reality only leads Job at this point into further despair. And he doesn't seem to be at all comforted by reason or logic or all those, you know, moral educated arguments about the nature of suffering. So what does help? What does save Job in this story? What saves us? What allows us, you and I, to offer heartfelt gratitude and thanks in a world so filled with heartache and suffering and challenges and tragedy? When Job says, I looked for good and then evil came upon me, when I expected light, I came upon darkness, I think he's describing very accurately the human condition. he's acknowledging here that suffering is unavoidable, that it's a given in life, but that it's not your fault and it's not God's punishment. I mean, the first noble truth of Buddhism is what? To be alive is to know pain. To be alive in this world is to know suffering and pain. And what saves Job, what helps Job, is, I think, in part that he's living out this drama in the midst of a compassionate community. I mean, yes, his friends can be irritating. Yes, his friends maybe say things that are not very helpful from time to time. But they still play a significant part in this drama, in this story, because what they do is they egg Job on to question and to discard his old understanding of this punitive, legalistic God. And they stand with him. The story says that 7 days in silence, his friends stand with him before they even speak. Would that they have shut up a little longer, but what is that? That's a ministry of presence, right? Where words don't have to be spoken, but we are present to each other in trial and in rejoicing. And I think a community, any community, this community at its best, is that kind of community, is a compassionate community. And what gets said or sung here on any given Sunday, you know, it may not provide particular comfort that you're seeking, but we're here together. We're walking through the valley of the shadow together. And we're bearing testimony each and every day that survival is possible. St. Augustine said, "By reason of my own pain and struggles, I have come to know compassion." And that's it. That's it, man. I mean, a compassionate community is made up of human beings like you and me, full of joy and heartbroken at times, talented and flawed, sometimes good and sometimes not so good, sometimes howling with complaint, and sometimes resting in a kind of blissful peace and contentment. But what mostly, I think, saves Job in this story is that he wants to see God. He wants to know that God is present even in his suffering. And that matters more than any explanation in terms of what he's going through. Job wants, as we all do, this direct encounter with God. And he knows that only as he experiences God will his longing be satisfied, regardless of the circumstances of his life. What saves Job is his understanding that life and truth and religion is fluid and mysterious and ever-evolving. So, as you gather at table this Thursday with whatever collection of friends and loved ones and oddball acquaintances, with your table heaped high with everything delectable, remember that God is present too. That there's no circumstance in life where God isn't present. You cannot keep God out. That's what this story is about, I think. It's about seeing God in the world. It's about being with God in any and all circumstances, in trials and in rejoicing. It's about seeing God. Hey, in a piece of bread. Jesus said it best. "This is my body. Take, eat." God in a piece of bread. God incarnate. God with us no matter what the circumstances of our lives. We're all a part of that mystery. The mystery of God, you know, in a meteor shower or in a crisp Sunday autumn afternoon. The mystery of God in the eyes of the person sitting right next to you right now, or in the eyes of a stranger. The mystery of God in a crust of bread, you know, that complex product of grain and yeast and sun and rain and human hands. I mean, let all of these holy human things ground us in that relationship, in that miracle, in that mystery. The mystery of God clothed in everything, no matter how small or confused or painful even, despite all of life's uncertainties and imperfections and unanswered and unanswerable questions. Feast upon it. The mystery of God. And please don't forget to say thanks for whatever crumb or crust or quick kiss of the sun comes your way. Peace of God.
Listen, listen, listen.